You're listening to RTE's Insights podcast with Sean O'Rourke. Please note a trigger warning for this episode. The conversation includes references to suicide. There's a link to a page with relevant helplines in the show notes.
How difficult it is, whereas I think with any other community, if you look at it, and it's great that, you know, kind of, whether it's Ukrainian people that was invited in to stay in people's houses, and that when it comes to travellers, it's something that the ESRI has identified now, is that travellers are kind of, when it comes to travellers, there's a real kind of exclusion that's really there, you know, and particularly around accommodation.
Hello again and welcome to the Insights podcast with Sean O'Rourke. My guest in this edition is a counsellor who holds a Bachelor of Science in Psychotherapy and a Master's degree in Counselling Supervision. He's also a proud member of the travelling community and a long-time traveller activist. Having left school at 11, Thomas McCann returned to education in his mid-20s and became the first traveller to be admitted to Maynooth University when he began his undergraduate studies. And in 2024, he became the first traveller to be conferred with a doctorate from Maynooth for a PhD on the traveller struggle for human rights in Ireland. Dr. Thomas McCann, you're welcome to the Insights podcast. Tell me first of all about your early life as a member of the travelling community. Where did you live?
Mainly I lived in Ballyfermot, around Ballyfermot. I remember kind of looking at my birth cert. I was born in the Coombe, the old Coombe Hospital, the end of Mead Street. And I remember looking at my birth cert and it said Campsite, Long Mile Road. So it was around Ballyfermot. People, a lot of travellers started moving. When they started moving from like rural parts of Ireland to Dublin, when changes was happening in the late 40s and 50s, they stayed on the outskirts of the cities. And that was one of the places my...
And at what stage, Thomas, did you become aware that you were a traveller and that other ways of life existed?
At a very early age, Sean, you become... One of my earliest memories was being at a funeral, my grandmother's funeral in Trim. And we were walking, and how I remember it is there was a... We used to wear these old kind of nail boots, and one of the nails was kind of hurting my foot. And I was crying all the way down to the graveyard. We walked from the church to the graveyard. But the whole town closed down. That was my earliest memory, I think, you know, because I remember my mother trying to get something and we couldn't get it. It was a very early memory. And I think it was about four, because I was looking at my grandmother's grave recently.
From town to town, did you pack up and move on? And if so, what was that like?
Yeah, you moved. We moved a lot, mainly around, as I said, we moved around Ballyfermot a lot. We stayed, you know, kind of in different places. You wouldn't be left that long. There was a site built in one of the first sites in Ireland was in Ballyfermot in Labour Park. And so we moved in there for a few years and then we moved out of there again. We moved on again. So,
and when you say you wouldn't be left that long in a place, I mean, who moved you on? Was it the council?
The council and the guards, you know, kind of. But usually it was the council or the corporation at the time, you know, kind of.
So in those circumstances, education, you know, wasn't something you could easily benefit from. So how did you go about getting education?
Yeah, well, the first school I went to was in Labour Park on that site.
Did you go to school consistently for any length of time or any particular place?
The two schools I went to a little bit consistently. One was the All Traveller School in Labour Park. That was a prefab at the top of the site. That was one. And that was probably for, I'd say, 2 or 3 years on and off, you know, kind of. That was. And then when we moved out of there, we moved down to down near Inchicore, and I went to the model school.
What do you remember about, say, summertime when there wouldn't have been school? I mean, did you play football or what did you do? Or did you engage much with the settled community?
No, didn't engage that much at all with the settled community, even with the... Because, as I said, the first school I went to was an all-traveller school in a model school in Inchicore, which is still there, and the principal was a very nice man. I remember him very well. Very nice guy.
It's been observed through various studies that while on the one hand, travellers don't, or people from the travelling community don't get the benefit of education, it's also suggested, though, that there's no real appreciation in traveller culture of education.
No, I have to say, Sean, I would really challenge that, because I know my mother and I've never met any traveller family who didn't want their children. And being totally honest about that, my mother always made an effort, no matter where we were, to try and get us into school, you know. And the same with my younger brothers. When we moved from there, she would always make an effort to get them into school.
How many of you were there in family?
There was six of us. There were six boys in the family. There was three older than me.
So you left school at what age then?
Certainly was would have been around 11, 11 and a half, that time. You know, I wouldn't have spent any longer than that in it.
And what did you do then?
After that, we kind of, you just started working and doing stuff, doing what the family was doing, you know, collecting scrap, you know, doing all kinds of things, you know, kind of. My father could turn his hand to anything, really, you know.
Were you happy as a youngster?
Yes. I mean, I was. And also, it was tough at times as well. It was quite tough at times, you know, kind of. So it was, sometimes we're happy, yeah. But sometimes it was very tough as well. I'm not going to, that kind of, you know, that you weren't accepted into places and you kind of, you know, you were just told you weren't allowed in, you know, kind of sometimes even into the cinema, you know.
What would have been your earliest memory of, say, being, you know, discriminated against, say, where it might have involved going into a pub or a cafe or something like that?
Yeah, it happened loads of times, but it was kind of, the memories that come back is that once, now, it was, you know, when you're in your teens, late teens, early 20s, you want to go, you had to think about where you were going to go before you went out. You know, you had to think about where you might be served, because when you went into a pub, you wouldn't be served. And especially if you were on your own, you might escape. You might come under the radar. But if you were with, if it was two or three, well, you wouldn't be served, you know.
And how would they know?
I didn't know by the way you were talking, by the way you were probably at the time as well, dressed, maybe, you know, kind of. And you wouldn't be dressed badly, you know, kind of. But to know by the way you were interacting as well, you know. I mean, when you're, like, people have a certain way. And, I mean, I remember reading some, I think it was Winnicott that said it, people have a cultural filter. And so people had asked you, well, where are you from? You know, and you said, Dublin, you know. And he said, oh, God, you don't have a Dublin accent, you know. Where in Dublin, you know. So this was, now that's when you'd be talking to people. But that would be the kind of, you know.
It's a bit like in Northern Ireland back in the day, you know, once you were asked what school you went to.
Yeah, people are trying to figure out, you know.
For a long time, you know, there was a campaign by traveller activists to get recognition as a separate ethnic community, to get recognition for that.
Yeah.
And we actually have a clip here of the day that actually happened, courtesy of the then Taoiseach Enda Kenny.
Yeah.
Cian Corda, thank you for making time in the House today for this historic and symbolic recognition of travellers as an ethnic group within the Irish nation. Robbie is a 17-year-old young man, his future ahead of him, the world at his feet. Yet he has walked with his head down. Today's statement of recognition of travellers as an ethnic group will go some way to ensuring that Robbie and his entire traveller family have a better future, with less negativity, less exclusion, less marginalisation. As the House is aware, the traveller community has for many years campaigned to have their unique heritage, culture and identity formally recognised by the Irish state. As Taoiseach, I now wish to formally recognise travellers as a distinct ethnic group within the Irish nation. May all the people of our nation live in the shelter and never in the shadow of each other. Or as the good traveller man taught me how to say, in the cant, this is a body tholish for the mean care.
It's coming up on 8 years now from when that statement was made by the Taoiseach, March 2017.
Yeah.
Did it actually make any difference?
It did in one way. It didn't have any rights attached to it or any changes. So it didn't make any changes for people on the ground, for travellers on the ground. However, what it did was, Sean, and I think this is an important point, is that it put to bed this idea that travellers are failed settled people. And that was the whole premise of the 1963 itinerancy report in terms of assimilation. That really travellers were failed settled people who dropped out of the famine and needed to be rehabilitated and brought back into the settled community. That recognition of ethnicity put that to bed, because travellers we knew, that's not the reality, and many others knew as well. And even the alternative history, as it's called, through laws that was made against travellers in the past, you could see that wasn't the...
And one of those laws might not have been, I think it was 2002, Section 24 of the Housing Miscellaneous Provisions Act. That had a big impact on the travelling community. In what way?
A huge impact, in terms of that it criminalised nomadism. More research needs to be done on this. But if you look at the correlation between the mental health crisis, among travellers now, you see a correlation between the anti-trespass, as is known, legislation and the mental health crisis. Because there was a study done in 2003 by a woman called Mary Rose Walker on suicide. And at that time, suicide was 2 to 3 times higher. And if you look now, we have a mental health crisis. From my own training, both as a psychotherapist and indeed now I'm doing studies around trauma, that there's a historical trauma from that oppression and the racism that you face from your child. I mean, that has to impact.
Obviously, there are issues like segregation, discrimination, isolation, but can you understand or what's your attitude, say, to members or some members of the settled community who have experienced instances of intimidation, antisocial behaviour, theft at the hands of individuals they believe to be travellers, and they don't want to engage with travellers?
Yeah, of course you can understand when people feel intimidated or, threatened in any way. But we have to realise that that happens in every community, but we don't punish the whole community for that. I mean, you know, certainly, like if I was to just turn that on its head for a second and say the amount of time that my family and the travel community was intimidated by settled people and even marched on and caravans attacked and stuff like that. But that's not all members of the settled community. You know, I think we have to differentiate between the actions of some individual members and the community that somebody comes from.
That brings me to your return to education. Having left school at 11, you went back in your mid-20s. You were about 25. Now, what brought that about?
It was activism, Sean. In the early 80s, I became active. Some of my brothers was active. Nan Joyce was active. She was living out in the Tala Bypass at the time.
She stood for election, I think, at one
stage. She stood for election, 1982 general election. There was a lot of marches by settled people. Now, there were mainly, I believe, vigilantes, because it was very intimidating, very threatening. They closed off roads, they set up roadblocks, and you had to show that you lived in a house. And they were marching on traveller trailers, and I believe in one or two cases, trailers got burned. So nobody was doing anything about this. And so Nan and a couple of settled people from Tala got together and set up the Committee for the Rights of Travellers. That was the first, kind of in the 1980s. I got involved in the Committee for the Rights of Travellers and was supporting that. And then we set up a traveller kind of, an all-traveller group called Minkir Misli. And that was very active. But it was just to sit down with travellers ourselves. And it was through that process I felt that I needed a framework or something for my activism. And at the time, John O'Connell, Stacey Quickly, and a few others, Mervyn Ennis and that, set up a course, a short course, 6-month course in Mead Street on community development. Community development was really only coming into Ireland at the time. It had been used in the UK, you know.
Did you feel that you would be listened to more carefully by people if you did have some academic standing?
It wasn't for the academic standing. It was more for my own kind of activism and for the community, how I'm going to mobilise people, you know, how we're going to achieve what we want to achieve. The focus was on that. It wasn't on me becoming, you know, kind of recognised or doing any of that. I think I was quite angry as well, you know, kind of anger was driving it because I wanted change and I didn't.
So you started with a BSc in psychotherapy and then you moved on, you got yourself a master's in counsellor supervision.
Yeah. Well, in Maynooth, I did the first 2-year course in community development in 1985 to 87. And then when I finished that, I was saying I was burned out. So I went off travelling for a while, for a few years. When I came back, there was the same situation, the same, like my family was living in a field in Black Rock, no facilities. It hadn't changed. Like, in that time that I was away, it hadn't shifted at all.
And when you were away, presumably you could walk into a bar and there was no question of being identified as a traveller or refused service.
No, there was none of that at all. None of that at all. And there was no problem with getting work or anything like that, you know, so, yeah.
And then did you?
And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed that engagement as well. Why I came back was I was getting involved at the time. I was down in Hong Kong and I was working on, working on that. But I was getting involved. There was supporting people in the camps. There was, I think it was Vietnamese people at the time in the camps, and supporting, doing fundraisers and stuff like that. I was asking myself a question, why am I getting involved with this group of people when my own people is kind of in this situation back in Ireland? And, you know, so I came to a point that I either stayed out or came back. You know, that was the point, and so I decided to come back.
And what was it like when you got back? What did you do?
I thought, okay, what am I going to do when I get back? I got involved in some of the organisations I went in. The Irish Traveller Movement had just kind of been established. I got involved in that. I enrolled in Trinity in the best. I did an entrance exam and passed and enrolled in Trinity and got in. But there was very few activists at the time. So after a year, I was running from lectures, which I really enjoyed, actually. I left Trinity because there wasn't enough activists involved. And then, after that, I worked in the ITM and I decided, I came to a question in my own head, the situation I would be in, had I not been born a traveller, because being an activist in that was all due to circumstances. Mm. You know, and I mean, I'm not sure, but I asked myself the question and I was thinking, well,
what would my life have been like had I not been born a traveller?
Or what would I have liked to do?
Mm.
And if I had the opportunity, and one of the things that I was enjoying was personal development and kind of counselling. So I did a foundation course in counselling in Tivoli in Dún Laoghaire, and I really enjoyed it and was really drawn to it. And so for the next 4 years, I studied psychotherapy. Got a degree from the Tivoli, so that they were connected at the time, and then went. And during that process, a lot of traveller groups, this is when the mental health crisis was starting to kind of develop. So I had a meeting with a number of people from around the country and had that discussion went on for quite a long time. And that's where the Traveller Counselling Service came out of. It was out of them discussions because there was nothing there for travellers. There was no culturally appropriate service for anyone, really. And also it was out of many people's reach to go to counselling. And there was, at the same time, there was an over-medication of the traveller community, and that came out in reports in terms of anxiety, depression.
I mean, does culture play a role or part in the suicide rates among travellers?
Well, it wasn't there. I mean, it's really interesting. It wasn't there. I mean, you know, traveller culture is very old in terms of, you know, kind of going way back. And it wasn't there when research was done. The Commission on Itinerancy, they carried out a report in 1963 and they looked at the health and they looked at all of that. And one of the things that they said is that there was no significant mental health issues among the traveller community. That was a national study. And that was in the 1960s. So, and even though the conditions was bad, you know, because sometimes people might put it down to the conditions or that, even though the conditions were bad, I mean, we didn't have that level of suicide. We didn't have that level of mental health, you know. So the changes kind of, you could see that there's, again, the connection between the change that went on from that time to this, you know, kind of in terms of, you know.
Did you do much lobbying, say, of politicians, be they ministers or civil servants or local councils? Was that part of your activism?
A lot, I would say, and travellers now around the country. I mean, you know, kind of certainly through the Irish Traveller Movement and other groups, there's many local traveller organisations now. You know, there is kind of participation on local structures as well. Mm-hmm. But the issue of accommodation is a very politicised issue, you know. Like you've seen that, I mean, the most stark example of that was in 2015 when the Carrick Mines, and I was involved in supporting the group out there and, you know, having lived in the area.
That was the big fire when 10 people died.
And then, their site was burned out. They couldn't go back onto the site and it was proposed that they would stay in this field temporarily until a site was built, and there was a protest, you know, in the middle of that. So that tells you how difficult it is. Whereas I think with any other community, if you look at it, and it's great that, you know, kind of whether it's Ukrainian people that was invited in to stay in people's houses, and that when it comes to travellers, it's something that the ESRI has identified now, is that travellers are kind of, when it comes to travellers, there's a real kind of exclusion that's really there, you know, and particularly around accommodation.
But now you were travelling abroad and then you came back. I suppose you were footloose and fancy free, so to speak.
Yeah.
But then you got married. You got married to a member of the settled community.
I did.
How did that come about?
That came about through, I used to kind of drink in a pub where, kind of a lot of activists used to drink Grogan's, and a lot of students and that, and kind of, and I knew a good few of the people there, and Beatrice, my wife, used to also drink there, and she knew a good few of the people. So we knew some of the same people, you know, and And it really happened from there, and kind of, you know, so I met her in a pub.
And did your family express any hopes that you would marry within the community, or were her family wary of her marrying a member of the traveller community?
Yeah, I'm sure they were. And kind of certainly my family, my mother and father, they wouldn't have been advising against it. But one of the things that we grew up with was this idea that you can never trust a member of the settled community. That's what I grew up with, you know. That no matter how well you know them, they'll turn against you, you know. And so I grew up with that. Now, I didn't somehow internalise that. So, yeah, so I'm married to a member of the settler community.
And did Beatrice have to endure comments, you know, derogatory about, you know, her marrying into the traveller community?
Yeah, there was a lot of fears, you know, that I was going to, that she was going to be on a site somewhere. And, you know, there would have been a lot of fears.
Yeah,
know?
But I mean, like, for instance, like, where did you go as a married couple? Did you live in a trailer, or did you get a house or whatever?
I was living in a trailer, because I lived in a trailer or a caravan most of my life, you know, kind of. It was only really when I got married. Now, off and on, I might have spent maybe 6 or 8 months somewhere here and there. But generally, I always had a mobile home, like, for, you know, kind of, and lived in it. And so Beatrice didn't, she used to come out to the site where I lived, you know, but she didn't want to live on a site. She wanted to live in a house. And I can understand why. I mean, you know, kind of, there's not great facilities on the site. There's like, I mean, it's like, you know. So I ended up moving into a house. And so I've been living in a house since I was married.
And did you have any trouble getting a house to live in?
We were living in a flat for a good while. And then, you know, and it was a small flat as well. And we had one child, Lucy. And, you know, kind of, and then... we actually ended up buying a small cottage. So we did just on off Cork Street, one of the small cottages there at the time.
And you took it from there.
Got a mortgage and stuff like that.
And what about your siblings? I mean, you're the one who went back to education.
Yeah.
I mean, are they still on sites, or what's the story there?
No. 3 of my brothers died, unfortunately, in the 1980s, you know, kind of one by accident in the canal. I think, you know, alcohol was involved in all them deaths. Now, it wasn't alcohol that caused them. One by suicide and one in a car accident, all in between 1981, 1982, you know, kind of, you know, 2 older brothers, 1 younger brother. My 2 other brothers, they're not living on the site. Once my mother died, we kind of all moved from the site. It kind of, that was, you know, well, I was off it anyway. But the rest, everybody else kind of. And so that space, as I said, that was gone, you know.
And is part of traveller culture still that there would be arranged marriages?
In some places there are. I mean, you know, arranged, when I said arranged, there would be kind of, you know, being matched with somebody. Now, it wouldn't be kind of the formal thing. It'd be kind of more subtle, kind of saying, you know, families coming together and kind of suggesting that there might be somebody there, you know, kind of. But there would, the more traditional families. And there'd be different families. I mean, one of the things I think that maybe the settled community forget is that there's diversity in the traveller community. Like in any community, there's diversity. Diversity of beliefs, political beliefs, kind of more diversity happening around religious beliefs as time goes on. More, you know, there'd be diversity, you know, kind of.
So this is a very general question. Yeah. Do travellers vote?
Yeah, travellers do vote. But not in the numbers that you would like travellers to vote in. And there has been campaigns, you know, throughout the years to get travellers to vote. Many travellers, for starters, going back a bit, you know, you had to be registered in an area to have a vote. For 6 months, you had to be in the area. So there was travellers had been excluded from voting for so long that it was very difficult then to get people to vote. But the other thing is, you'd rarely see a politician coming out to a site. You know, you'd rarely see a politician coming out and saying, this is what we're going to do, or, you know, kind of, very rarely.
Because whatever about them maybe winning votes from travellers, they'd be afraid that if this gets around, settled people
absolutely
won't vote
for them. In fact, it's the other side of the coin in terms of them making statements against travellers that got some people votes.
Is it still the case that a lot of travellers, they marry young? In their late teens.
Yeah. Most travellers. Not most. Many travellers do. That's changing, though, as well, Sean, you know, because many now kind of are going on to education. Many younger travellers are kind of looking at you know, careers now, whereas that maybe wasn't always the case in the past either because of course, the racism and history.
And what about your own family now, Thomas? They're, you know, in their teens and, yeah, and 20s. Yeah. I mean, like, how do they identify? I mean, do they see themselves as part traveller, part settled, or how has that worked out?
Yeah, they're members of both communities. I don't see it as half and half. I see it as, you know, kind of, I see both. And I think there's, you know, Beatrice's family also, you know, that there has to be a pride about the family, that her family and where they came from and the war, you know. But I think there's a pride about being traveller as well, you know, kind of certainly, you know. Now, they wouldn't be going around shouting it, but certainly my daughter would be working in kind of, you know, in public appointments at the minute, and she's very much part of promoting traveller inclusion and that, and traveller pride. She does stuff within the department to support that, you know. My other daughter who's studying psychology would be, and they would have done a lot of their school kind of projects on travellers. They would have written about, because some of my relatives would have been very well-known musicians. Paddy Keenan, for instance, is a cousin of mine, a first cousin of mine, and many others, you know. So there would be sides of the family that they would have kind of looked at, you know, and said, right, OK, we'll write something about. So my thinking on children is you have to support them to come to that place that they, you know, that they feel good about identifying.
By traveller standards, you married quite late in life, didn't you?
I did, yeah. I did marry quite late in life, and that used to be always highlighted to me as well, you know. In fact, Sean, I didn't think I was going to get married. I had been in relationships, and one other long-term relationship that didn't transpire into marriage. And after that, I didn't think I was going to kind of, you know, get married. So it all changed.
So what's your view on the idea of marrying young then?
Well, my personal view is that I wouldn't be encouraging my children to get married young. Do what you want to do and then kind of get married, you know. And so that would be my... Now, there's two sides to that kind, you know. I mean, I got married a bit later. I had children a bit later. So you're at this end of the spectrum now, in my 60s now, and I have a 15-year-old son, you know, kind of. And you know, if you get married younger, and I'm not... I wouldn't be promoting like teenage marriage, but if you get married younger, you know, your children are growing up with you a bit as well, you know, and you have that kind of, you know. So I think there's two sides to the story as well, you know.
Yeah. What about the LGBTQ representation? I mean, it's obviously much easier for people now to come out as gay in society generally. What about in the travel community?
I think it has changed a lot. I think a lot of work has been done within the travel community. You know, there's been a lot of discussions, and I think particularly gay men being able to come out, traveller men being able to come out rather than women. I think there is some women emerging, but I think it's much more difficult for the women. It has become, I won't say, you know, it's still difficult for many people, but I think there's a space has been created for that to happen, you know. And I mean, the traveller groups has won the Gay Pride Award, you know, like that's shifted things. Now, there's another level to that, Sean, and that is that there's discrimination against travellers within the gay community as well. So you have that as well, you know. So it's not straightforward, you know. So it's very difficult for gay, lesbian and bisexual travellers to kind
even
of...
Even within the wider gay community.
Yeah, and that has been... And we've had discussions about that, you know, kind of, in terms of how that might be tackled and within the gay community, you know. But there'd be a lot of support within the wider traveller movement for LGBT issues and making sure that they're included, you know, because as I said, there's diversity, you know, and that's part of the diversity and the makeup of the travel community. There's many LGBTQ plus people within the travel community, and that needs to be
Why do you think it's harder for women to come out?
I'm not sure. I think that maybe there's more, certainly, you know, traditionally and the more traditional families, there's more control in terms of on women,
women. Women, you know, enjoy less freedom.
Less freedom, yeah. Now I'm talking about teenage kind of freedom than younger boys or men, you know, kind of. They can kind of go off and kind of, I won't say do what they like, but, you know, whereas with girls there's much more kind of control.
Like, you know? If you were a woman, would you have found it as easy to go travelling as you did all across the world?
I don't think so, unless... Well, I could have done, if I was determined enough, I could have done, but it would have been... I think it would have been more difficult. It would have been certainly more difficult for me as a travel woman, I think, definitely. There's no doubt about that.
Are travellers more likely to have a substance abuse problem?
There's a very, yeah, there's a, and an increasing one at that, there is. And like, I mean, and again, you know, drug addiction and also prescribed medication. As I said earlier on, there was an overprescription of medication. But in terms of, like, say, for instance, illegal drugs, you know, kind of, you know, I remember a time when people wouldn't smoke a joint on a site. It wouldn't be acceptable. Now, you know, kind of, there is that. And I suppose, again, when people, you know, there was a time when people would be able to move on from an area to say, well, actually, things is getting out of hand here. You know, the children are getting involved in too much bother. Let's move. Families can't do that anymore. So that's also part of it. Like, that whole generation has grown up that you couldn't move out of a situation.
You said you met your wife in a pub.
Yeah,
actually,
yeah.
Is it the case that neither of you drink now?
Neither of us drink, yeah. I think I was binge drinking. I'd start on a Thursday and finish on a Sunday and get on with the week, you know, and that went on for years. And it was, and I was dependent on it, you know, kind of. It was causing me problems. So, you know, and I didn't want that, to bring that into my family. So when I had children, I stopped drinking. And then Beatrice kind of, you know, drank for a little while after that. And then she decided to stop, you know.
Do you feel much healthier as a result?
I do, yeah. No, I think it was a good decision. I think most of the study, and she reminds me of this, was that I did because I was working full time, was on the weekends. So them weekends, all them weekends would have been...
Yeah, we know now, the economists talk about full employment Ireland at the moment, which I think is anything under 4% unemployment. So what's it like in the traveller community? I mean, is there a difficulty with a traveller finding a job?
Yeah, there is. And I mean, I've had sessions with young men and, you know, teenagers and that, and they don't even get to an interview, you know. Like, so they don't, and there is, and I mean, this has been shown again and again, is that this, like, I know the last statistics was, I think it was around 62% unemployment in the travel community. Now, many believe it's much higher than that again, I think. But many of the people who are employed, including myself, is employed in travel organisations, you know. So the wider labour market is where the difficulty is in terms of employment.
But is there not a possibility that you could work with, you know, the Construction Industry Federation or people who can organise apprenticeships have a programme whereby, you know, fears would be eased or the people would be given a chance?
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, kind of on building sites and that, many people really, if they found out they were a traveller, people hide their identity because when you found out you were a traveller, you were let go. You know, that's the way it was, you know. And there is an apprenticeship scheme. I think certainly the Irish Traveller Movement is involved in an apprenticeship scheme, looking at apprenticeship schemes and trying to get companies into apprenticeship schemes that would take on travellers. And there are some travellers who are on apprenticeship schemes now. But I think the whole issue of racism and discrimination needs to be looked at in the wider labour market
In the construction industry, Thomas, I mean, there are people from...
Yeah, it's not just the construction industry.
No, but I'm just saying that they're crying out for people, skilled and unskilled, to work in that.
Yeah, and it's really difficult. And a lot of the travellers who hasn't been employed in construction would be kind of on building sites and that, and, you know, kind of... There's this mistrust of travellers, Sean. There's this racism towards travellers that they're going to do something wrong if they're employed. And I think, you know, if we're going to change, because that then leads to poverty, you know.
This is possibly an unfair question.
Yeah,
might some of that fear be warranted?
No, I don't think so. I think you can't. I know Martin Luther King said something in terms of not judging people by the colour of their skin, you know. Mm. It's similar. You don't judge people by the cultural background that they come from. you know, in terms of, you know, you judge them by their own, by the merits that they stand on and by, you know, kind of by their own qualities.
You've been an activist now for over 40 years,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
How much have things improved over that time?
There's two different levels to this. One level, there is improvements in terms of, if you look at, of course, we got recognition as, you know, an ethnic group. You had Eileen Flynn in the Shannon, appointed to the Shannon, which is great. And I hope, because that really kind of gives us a platform and also visibility. And I think it does bring about change. There has been, like, also then you have, of course, you have programmes going on, school programmes, and, you know, in terms of transition into third level and that. And they're all very well. But on the ground for people, it hasn't changed a lot. If you look at travellers on the ground, if you look at the accommodation issues, if you look at the employment issues, if you look at the health.
Housing?
Housing. It's like it right across the board, because now what you have is you have very little traveller accommodation being provided. You have people being forced into private rented to come down that route. Mm-hmm. And you know how hard it is for general population. Much more. And now you have growing increase of homeless travellers, which we didn't have in the past. So on the ground, it's very, very difficult for people. And a lot of there hasn't been really the change, that level of change that's needed, you know.
What is your ambition now for the travelling community looking ahead?
I think I always believe that we can create change, that, you know, and collectively with the wider population, we can create positive change. I think it's the mindset, as somebody says, or as I identified in the thesis, the ideology, that sedentarist ideology that's there for generations that we carry from one generation into the next. I think we need to, because no matter how many proposals we have on the table, unless they're translated into action, they won't turn into anything positive.
Is there, does it ever cross your mind you'd like to hit the road again?
Yeah, I do get the urge, Sean. I mean, it took me a long time to adjust to living in a house, I think. I mean, when I say adjust, I mean, I miss the camp. I miss the campsite. I miss that extended family, because, like, you came back to that. No matter where people were, they all came back to that space. Once that's gone, it's like it's very hard to recreate, even though you might go travelling and that. Mm. It's very hard to recreate that dynamic where people are sitting around an open fire, chatting or drinking tea or talking about what went on, or, you know, if somebody does play music or whatever. In some ways, and I talked to Beatrice about this, my wife, many times, there's a loss in that. There's a loss for me in that, of that, you know, that I can't recreate that, even though I can go travelling on my own or with, you know, with my...
I mean, for instance, you could go to a campsite in France and light a barbecue or whatever.
We do. We do. Mm. We went off. We went to England, Scotland, Wales, to the campsites, and also in France and in Spain as well. You know, lovely campsites, and the kids loved it and we enjoyed it. But it's not that dynamic that you had as an extended family camping with. It's not... You grieve that loss at some level, you know, kind of. And that's there, you know, so it is. But I do look forward to a time maybe when I have an old field somewhere and, you know, I'm able to put a few mobile homes in it and people can come and stay with me.
Thomas McCann, Dr. Thomas McCann, it's been absolutely fascinating listening to you. Thank you so much for your time and for your insights.
Thank you very much, Sean.
To hear more in this series, go to rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.